This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the audio space where in 28 short minutes, you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, the care sector and the coronavirus, what the latter has told us about the former. This week, we began to get a much clearer picture of how many people are dying with coronavirus in our care homes. And the story is pretty grim. This week, I want to know what these statistics and others tell us about the state of social care in the UK and whether long-delayed reform to the sector has now become inevitable. Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with the figures about deaths in social care that came out this week. Alison Holt is the BBC's social affairs correspondent. Alison, my first question is, what do we mean by care home? What does it cover?
What we're talking about here are residential homes for people who are older and disabled who have a reasonable level of need. And we're talking about nursing homes. So there they will have a much higher level of need for support with that medical input from a nurse.
OK, so let's look at the sombre statistics for a moment. What do we know currently about the number of people who have died from coronavirus in care homes?
Well, probably the best statistics to look at are those from the Office for National Statistics, and they published their latest set of figures on Tuesday. They showed a third of all coronavirus deaths in England and Wales are now happening in care homes. There is a bit of a time lag on them, but in the week ending April the 17th, there were 2,000 deaths in care homes in England and Wales. And that brings the total number of deaths since the start of the pandemic to 3,096.
Are these the figures for the UK or just for England and other separate ones for Scotland?
These figures are for England and Wales. The figures for Scotland have tended to come out in their daily briefings, but their latest briefing suggested that about 50% of the deaths from coronavirus that they're seeing are happening in care homes.
OK, what about infection rates in care homes?
Well, about a third of care homes in England have had an outbreak of confirmed or suspected COVID-19. And that's according to the data collected by Public Health England.
What do the experts think, the people who look at this, think about whether or not we have reached the peak, which we have in the NHS apparently, in care homes, or whether it's yet to come?
I don't think that we know yet whether or not we've reached the peak. Certainly the suggestion is that we haven't, that we're not through it.
Now, there are a number of ways in which an infection can come, I imagine, into a community like that. One, obviously, is relatives. So they were prevented from coming in, what, from a relatively early stage in most care homes?
A lot of care homes took the decision early on to lock down. So that was before the government was saying that they should do that. They felt they were getting mixed messages. There was a lot of talk about protecting and shielding, but at that early stage, they didn't have the guidance to explain what that meant for them. They just reduced it right down to staff and residents.
Now, the second way in which it can come in is staff. What do we know about staff absences, rates of infection, testing for staff and so on?
Well, early on, there were indications that some care providers had, you know, 25% or more of their staff off self-isolating. They were losing a significant number of people because they were concerned they had the virus and they wanted to protect the people they were looking after. But one of the issues that kept being raised was testing. They were saying, if we had testing of our staff, we would know who had to self-isolate and who could be working.
What was the progression with regard to testing staff for care homes?
It took quite some time before care staff could get the testing that they needed. It's in the last few weeks that testing has been rolled out on a significant level. They were being given appointments at the drive-through testing units. And there were stories of care workers having to do 3-4 hour round trips to get that testing. One of the issues behind this is that care staff are low paid. They may not have a car. They may not be able to drive. And that is another layer of difficulty which wasn't really taken into account.
The third way is with new admittances and so on, some of whom would have come in from hospitals. There was a big policy element to that, wasn't there, Alison?
From the middle of March, the NHS put out a letter saying that hospitals needed to free up as many beds as they possibly could, ready for the inspected influx of coronavirus patients. And not all of the people who were moved to the care homes were tested. One of the themes that kept coming up from care providers was their real worry about whether people being discharged from hospital might bring coronavirus into their home. So they've locked down, they've done all they can to protect the residents, and they're taking someone in and they don't know whether or not they might have the virus. And that was clearly a cause of great concern.
What about personal protective equipment?
One of the things that happened at the start of this was that there was that rush to get protective equipment. And care homes found that their normal suppliers were not able to supply them any longer. They found that those supplies had been diverted to the NHS. So then they ended up scrabbling around trying to get more supplies.
Alison, there's something curious about this, just in straightforward policy terms. Right from the beginning of the pandemic, it was said, and it's true, that the most vulnerable people to dying from this disease would be the elderly and those with underlying conditions. You couldn't actually have defined better the care home sector. But in this area, you don't seem to have a joined up, massive, programmatic attitude. Or have I got that wrong?
I don't think you've got it wrong. At the start of this, we focused our efforts on protecting the NHS to save lives. I don't think anyone's going to argue with that. But sitting outside the NHS is the social care sector. Now is perhaps not the time, but there will come a time when we have to ask these questions about how we have handled the pandemic in terms of this very vulnerable group of people in these long-term care facilities.
Alison Holt. That's some of what's happened since the pandemic began. Now I want to understand what the care home sector actually is, who runs it, who funds it, and who works in it. William Leng is chairman and co-founder of Leng Buisson, which provides research on health and social care sectors. Give me an idea of numbers. How many care home providers are there in the UK and how many care homes?
In the case of the older people's care homes, there are about 10,500 care homes in total, with about 450,000 beds throughout the UK. Now, the providers range from quite large companies to micro providers. So overall, the total number of providers, around about 4,000 to 5,000. So it's quite fragmented.
Now, what do we know about the average age of residents in these homes?
Well, we know the average age is over 80, 83, 84, 85, something like that.
Okay.
We just don't know exactly.
And how long, on average, do residents spend in care homes?
There's not great data on this, but we believe it's around about 2.5 years.
And by and large, people leave it because they die?
Because they die, yes. A few people change homes. Very few will go home, but it's mainly because they die.
What's the proportion between people who are paying for themselves or for their families and local authority?
As of now, the proportion being funded by local authorities is in the high 40s. The proportion being funded privately by individuals and their families is in the low 40%, and the remainder is funded by the NHS.
Now, looking at the local authority element to that, which you've said is in the high 40s, what's happened to that funding in the last 10 years?
Well, it was hit fairly seriously by austerity. Our own figures showed that the local authorities were both restricting access to care home places by ratcheting up the criteria for admission. And they're also putting pressure on the fee levels that they're offering to the providers of care homes. Over the worst period of austerity, the real terms fee levels actually dropped by about 6%.
Now, how profitable is it for somebody to be in the care business? I mean, how solid are their finances?
Depends if they are focused on private pay or public pay. The organisations that have been traditionally in areas which are funded mainly by local authorities have done badly. Essentially, the story is that if you're in private pay and you're in the south of England, you're doing probably very well. If you're in public pay and you're in north of England, Midlands, you're probably doing badly.
That's very interesting. Now, how does that reflect itself in the conditions and pay for care workers?
People who are working at the coalface, that is the carers and the domestic assistants, typically they're paid just above national living wage, £9 an hour, £9 plus range. They do not get anything more than statutory benefits in the way of sick pay or pension or holiday.
So where would they fall in the pattern of earnings for employed people generally? Towards the middle or are they towards
bottom?
The bottom? They're at the bottom.
Bottom end. They're not right at the bottom, but at the bottom end.
And does the sector struggle to recruit?
It does struggle to recruit and there are lots of vacancies. The staff turnover is about 30% a year.
Now, let's talk about what has happened during the course of the pandemic. We've heard about the decision to take people out of the NHS hospitals, quite a few of whom have therefore gone into care. As far as you can tell, what has the impact of that been upon the care sector?
Well, there was an imperative to get people out of hospital as rapidly as possible. And what happened was that care homes were being asked to take people, which they were simply not prepared for. First of all, because they didn't have the PPE, the personal protective equipment, but also because at the time that these discharges were taking place, the amount of professional and clinical support that was available to care homes was simply disappearing. So I know particular cases where a care home had been used to having 3 visits a week from its local GP, and the GP rang and said, well, we're reducing that. You're going to have a phone call every week or 2 weeks. Cover from community health services went down, and of course, clinical support from the hospitals went way down as well. People who are ill in care homes and who would normally require hospital admission were simply being kept in the care home. and ambulances, in some cases, seem to be under orders simply not to go to care homes at all.
So you didn't just have a problem of people coming in, you also had the problem of people not being able to go out and get the care they needed, and also not getting the care that they had had before.
Exactly.
Do you think that the care home sector has been effective in organising in its own interests?
Look, as I said, there are about 4,000 or 5,000 providers. There was huge variation.
The picture you've drawn is one of a very diverse and, frankly, rather kind of fragmented sector. Has that fragmentation in the context of dealing with an approaching pandemic, has that been a problem?
Inevitably, it has. There is no central body for social care. Sure, there's a Department of Health and Social Care, but all they do is give out money to local authorities.
It's just not integrated, is it?
It's not integrated at all, no.
William Lang on care homes. But actually, those homes are just one part of the care sector. Huge numbers of people receive care in their own homes. How does that work, and what's happened there? Professor Jill Manthorpe is Director of the Health and Social Care Workforce Research Unit at King's College London. Jill Manthorpe, when we talk about the domiciliary sector, what are we talking about?
Mainly, I think people nowadays talk about home care. So every day, about 2 million home care visits are made to disabled or ill individuals in their own home by people who are helping them with everyday tasks, food preparation, sometimes helping people eat, and with personal care. And of the 8,000 and so registered home care agencies, there's a turnover that means that businesses close or change, about 500 a year. And the funding probably now is just not adequate to keep up with requirements on the sector to pay national living wage, to fund training, technology, to pay people for travelling between visits and so on. By and large, we're talking about small businesses that operate very locally. That, of course, makes them increasingly vulnerable when finances don't add up. And the businesses have to provide their own personal and protective equipment, and the cost of that have skyrocketed, if you can get it, as I'm sure you know.
Now, let's talk about the people who work in the sector. What kind of people are they? Under what circumstances and conditions do they work?
50% of people working in home care are on zero-hour contracts. It is flexible, but it's very precarious for managing your money and predicting what income is coming into your home. Most of them receive round about the national living wage, and there are difficulties, of course, about whether or not that pays for travel time in between different clients. So this is an area which certainly isn't low-skilled, but perhaps is not esteemed.
Now, let's look at the conditions of the pandemic. What particular concerns are there for people working in the home care sector arising from the coronavirus outbreak?
I think there is some sense that they've been pretty invisible in debates so far. But that reflects, I think, their invisibility over the past years, really. When people talk about social care, they often see care homes as representing social care, and somehow or other, because you don't see buildings, it's an individual going up somebody's front path into their house, it doesn't have the public presence of residential care.
And yet, precisely the way you put it, you're going up the front path into somebody's house, i.e. you're not maintaining significant social distancing, you're going into other people's houses. So what is the situation with home care workers and, for example, PPE?
We know that some people have decided not to have home care visits because of the risk, as they perceive it, of any visitors bringing infection into the home. We know for home care workers, they're troubled by different messages and different availability about personal protective equipment. And also, when you've got a relationship with somebody, it's very difficult to turn up in masks and visors and be seen in that way when your home care is about relationship that they value.
Now, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who are low paid in myriad different circumstances. Is there a central registration whereby not only do we know who those people are, but also they can be advised and contacted in a situation like this?
No, in England, no. That's a question for policymakers. Wales and Scotland have made different decisions. It's been on the agenda before the pandemic. The all-party parliamentary group in social care last year produced a report in which it very much asked policymakers to consider the registration of social care workers, not just to professionalise them, but to do the things you mentioned there, to actually know who this workforce is, but also that we would be able to perhaps have better chains of communication with them and that they would feel valued.
Professor Jill Manthorpe, what about other countries? What impact has the pandemic had on their care sectors and what can we learn from them? Adelina Comas-Herrera from the London School of Economics has been researching just that. She spoke to The Briefing Room's Rosamund Jones about some of her early findings.
Increasing, the problem is that not many countries are able to share that data. There's a lot of differences in how they do it. And part of the issue is that in some countries, they only record the confirmed deaths. But in some countries, like in Belgium, France and Ireland, they've started to also count what they call probable deaths. There hasn't been a test to confirm that they died due to COVID.
So the data is patchy and difficult to draw conclusions from. Nonetheless, can you give me some idea of the situation that we're seeing in certain countries?
In almost every country in the world, the long-term care systems don't tend to be very well resourced, and there are lots of problems with recruitment of staff and also with the level of pay. And we are very aware that this has been a huge factor in countries like Italy and Spain. In these countries, they also had the additional challenge that COVID exploded very, very fast, very quickly, and they became very rapidly overwhelmed in care homes.
One of the worst cases was in Madrid, where the army went in and found lots of dead bodies in the beds and that almost no staff were left in the home. And the reason that happened was a combination of a lot of people dying in a very short amount of time, a lot of staff having to stay at home because they were unwell themselves or they were risking their own families, and also the fact that the funeral services became overwhelmed.
So we have a bit of a cluster of countries that around half of the deaths have been of people who were either care home residents or died in care homes. That includes Belgium, France, Ireland as well. But the proportion seems to be going up and now nearing 60%. In Canada, the current rate seems to be 72%. In Norway, 60%. Portugal is about 40%. So we have quite a few countries clustering at around half. And then there are a number of countries like Germany, where the proportion seems to be quite a lot lower. In Germany, their data includes people who live in prisons and other communal accommodations, but it is much lower. It's only about a third of deaths seem to be in these communal establishments. So people who have been in hospital in Germany with COVID-19 before they might be discharged into a care home would have to have at least two negative tests for COVID within 48 hours. And there's also a requirement to have a doctor assessing that they're unlikely to have the virus. And this guidance is much more stringent than, for example, the current discharge processes in the UK. So in Germany and in a number of other countries as well, they're using some step-down facilities for people to be discharged from hospitals before they go back to either their own homes or into care homes. In Germany, they're using rehabilitation hospitals. In Austria, they're also considering and preparing some of these hospitals in case they need to use them. And in Spain, what they have done is to use hotels. So they've converted hotels into step-down settings where people can stay until there's confidence that they no longer have the virus.
And I guess one reason why that's so important is that it really is quite difficult to self-isolate in care homes.
Yes. Care homes are designed to be places where people interact and have joint activities and a joint life. And they're not designed to be isolation facilities, basically. I think that it's very important to make sure that care homes have some spare capacity at the moment, because of course if they're full and if we keep bringing in back people from hospital into care homes, it will be even harder to implement this physical distancing.
That low occupancy idea, is that happening anywhere in Europe?
Yes, so there are quite a few countries where they're trying to make sure that there's less discharge into care homes.
The difficulty is that when you have a lot of people living in a small space, once one of them becomes infected, this spreads very rapidly.
Adelina Comas-Herrera. Now that's the who, what, why and where else of social care. Finally, the what next. What changes to our care system might come out of the crisis? Natasha Curry is Acting Deputy Director of Policy at the Nuffield Trust. Natasha, firstly and more generally, do you think it's likely that COVID deaths outside hospital in the community are being underreported in the UK at the moment?
We think that deaths outside hospital are likely to be underreported. Because of the amount of testing we're doing, COVID doesn't always appear on a death certificate when maybe it should. When we look at deaths in care homes across Europe, we're looking at maybe 40% of all COVID deaths happening in care homes. So we think that there's a significant underestimation there.
Now, in what way does that reflect the problems in the social care sector?
We know that it's been chronically underfunded for a number of years. So we know that whilst need for care has been rising as a result of our ageing population and people living longer with disabilities and long-term conditions, etc., we know that less resource has been going into the system.
This is not a newly understood problem. People have been talking about this, to my certain knowledge, for a very long time. Could you just take us through the main points at which we have discussed altering the system significantly?
In the first big report into the issues was published in 1999, in the early years of the Blair government. That then led to some changes in Scotland, but nowhere else in the UK was bold enough to make any changes. There was a big review by Derek Wanless looking at different options for funding. Again, that didn't go anywhere. In 2009, we had a white paper. 2010 was very significant for social care. The Labour government at that time in their election campaign proposed the introduction of a national care service, which would be funded partly by inheritance tax. Now, that led to billboards with a gravestone on it saying the Labour's death tax. And then we saw that situation repeated in 2017 with Theresa May's proposals, and that was branded a dementia tax. When Boris Johnson took office in July last year, he promised to fix social care once and for all. It then came up as a significant issue in the run-up to the election, but there were very few concrete proposals in the Conservative manifesto. So this has become a very politically toxic issue that's very difficult for politicians to discuss.
So we have a situation whereby politicians have been very reluctant to come forward with proposals because the other politicians shoot them down at election time. But what about the public? What is your perception of why it is that the public doesn't effectively demand that there be a significant change?
I think it goes back to this low awareness among the public about how social care operates and how it's funded. There's an assumption that it's part of the NHS and free at the point of use. And I think it's difficult until you need social care to understand what it is.
Given everything you said, why would anything change now?
Well, if anything good comes out of this crisis, what I hope is that it's made social care much more visible. And I think that's helpful in raising awareness of what the service is, what the problems are within it, and therefore triggering a proper debate with the public about what we want from a service and what we're willing to pay for it. So maybe this could be the watershed moment that we need to end this 20 years of policy paralysis. When we've looked at system reform in other countries, Germany and Japan, for example, they've both been through a process of a long debate about what the options are. And the decision to implement reform has been forced by a major event. So in Germany, it was reunification. In Japan, it was the economic crash of the early 90s.
What would you hope would be the features of a reform system?
Any reform programme needs to be underpinned by some form of pooled funding, and it needs to be designed to work alongside other key services. So the health service, for example, it needs to be closely integrated with health. And in terms of the workforce, this crisis has really emphasised the fact that the care workers are essential and they are key. So we need them to be valued and adequately paid. There's an imbalance between how we treat the NHS workforce and how we treat the social care workforce.
You hope that there will be change as a consequence of this nasty jolt to our psychology and our systems. But do you seriously expect it?
Experience suggests that maybe we shouldn't expect it, but perhaps COVID-19 is our opportunity to really force reform through. I'm hopeful, I think, is as far as I can go.
Natasha Curry with her prediction, which I don't think I can better. My thanks to Alison Holt, William Lang, Jill Manthorpe, Adelina Comas Herrera, and Natasha Curry. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Luke Radcliffe, Sally Abrahams, and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Neva Misirian, and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Another edition of this podcast will be along soon. And if you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including the inequalities of lockdown, the psychological impact of the pandemic, easing the lockdown, and the coronavirus, from testing to vaccine. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.